that moment, he helped me to redefine or to look differently at the definition of a great mountaineer. And in fact, what he was really doing, I was paralleling it to my careers. Some of my greatest moments were either in that position as the giver of that or as the receiver of that. And it was one of those moments in time that you capture, that you plant inside your head and your heart, because it had nothing to do with technical expertise. It had everything to do with the reaction to the unexpected.
That's Chuck Garcia, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. The All Things Risk Podcast is my show. It's what I think is the best long-form podcast about risk and uncertainty that you'll find. It's certainly the most eclectic because risk is a life. Risk is all around us, and we look at risk from different lenses with some great guests, and we do this so that we can learn how to make some better decisions, take more risks, and take them more intelligently, and understand our world just that little bit more. Before we get to today's guest, let's take care of a little business. This episode is brought to you by Audible, where listeners to the All Things Risk podcast can get a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk if you're in the United States, or click on the link accompanying this post if you're in the UK. You can go to allthingsrisk.co.uk to find that. Choose over 180,000 titles, get something for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, and MP3 player. And you might be wondering, advertising? What? Listen to my last in-between episode where I explain. Now, let's get into today's episode, which is all about the power of communication, that and mountaineering, because these things are so intertwined, right? Not clear to you? Well, it will be by the end of today's episode. My guest is Chuck Garcia. Chuck is an executive coach. He's a professor at the Graduate School of Engineering at Columbia University in New York, and he's a speaker and an author. He's worked for many years at Bloomberg. He started way back when it wasn't this well-known financial news and media company, and he worked very closely with its founder, Mike Bloomberg. But Chuck is also a mountain climber, and he started his mountain climbing career in his early 40s, and we talk about all of that. But what this conversation really is about is communication and the parallels of effective communication, not just as an asset for what we do professionally and personally, which, by the way, is crucial, but also how great communication is very important when managing when things go wrong, which we obviously talk a lot about in this show about risk. And that's where some excellent parallels exist between climbing and communicating. And so much so that Chuck has written a wonderful book called A Climb to the Top: Communication and Leadership Tactics to Take Your Career to New Heights. And we get into all of that and more, including Chuck's expeditions, difficult conversations he had to have in the wake of 9/11, some communication principles, and loads more. I really enjoyed this. Chuck is a wonderful human being. I think you'll enjoy this as well. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Chuck Garcia. Welcome to the All Things Risk Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you, Ben. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be able to meet with you today, and I thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure and a real honor. I wanted to start with a question that I always ask of my guests. I don't have a set of pre-programmed questions, except probably for this one, and that is the classic: when you get asked what it is that you do, what is your response?
Yeah, the answer is a pretty fast one. However, it took a while to formulate it. I help others transform into powerful and compelling, astonishing communicators. That is my aspiration and my goal every time that I meet with somebody and I wake up in the service of their success. Put in a slightly different way to make it more tangible, I really do three things. Number one, I'm an executive coach, mostly to financial institutions. Number two, I'm a college professor. I teach in the Graduate School of Engineering at Columbia University. And number three, I'm a professional speaker. The first answer to your question is applicable to any one of those three things that I do for a living.
Okay, that's what we're going to get into, all of that. Before we do, I wanted to explore your background a little bit and understand the journey that you took to get to doing what it is that you do. You spent an awful lot of time on Wall Street. You worked in Bloomberg, you worked in sales and marketing. And maybe just to start, I'd be curious to understand what it is that you aspire to be when you were younger.
Yeah, when I grew up, I don't know, it was at 8 years old, I had seen a visual of the New York Stock Exchange and I saw the ticker tape and I had no idea what all of that was. But I was born and bred in the New York area. My dad's a college professor. He was a professor of linguistics at the United States Military Academy in West Point. And that's only 50 miles from New York. And even though it wasn't anything in my world, when I went into New York and I saw the lights, the camera, the action, I wasn't exactly sure what was going on at the New York Stock Exchange. The only thing, something instinctively said, I need to be a part of that. So for the rest of those years between high school and then I went to Syracuse University to major in finance, I had one goal only, and that was to get to Wall Street and to start a career that would do two things. Number one, it was a career that was dynamic and constantly changing, certainly ticked that box. And the second one, it was a career that would enable me to see the world. And indeed, I did. And I've probably traveled to several dozen, maybe 50 or 60 different countries as a result of what it is I did for a living when I finally got to Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. So was there any particular career path that you wanted to take in Wall Street? You gravitated towards sales and then business development, and now you're working as a, you know, you're working in communication. So yeah. All of that seems to me like there's a thread that runs through it around communication, but I'm curious how you saw that.
Yeah, indeed. It's a series of twists and turns. And what I didn't know and what I'm vigilant about teaching my students is that your career is a series of twists and turns, of opportunities, of conflict, of triumph, of a whole lot of things that you can't possibly predict. So my notion when I went to Wall Street is really a couple different things. There's commercial banking and there's investment banking and investment management, those three things. I wasn't exactly sure what it all meant. And when I got to college, it provided a little bit of clarity. So when I originally went to Wall Street, it was to become a commercial banker. And I started in a commercial bank, recruited right out of college, and I found, oh my God, this is not at all what I expected. I found it incredibly dull. I loved the finance part of it, but to be a banker, what did I know? This isn't it. So through a series of twists and turns that I don't have the time to explain, I don't think it'd be right in this venue, but it led me to somebody advise, hey, even if you're in finance, you can serve the financial arena and still whet your appetite for the subject matter of finance, yet you don't have to be a banker or a broker. And that was an amazing revelation. I said, oh my God, what is that exists? I didn't know. You know, when you're an undergraduate, all they tell you is finance, banking, broking. Okay. There's no one explained to us this massive cavern of how Wall Street actually gets serviced. So through happenstance, somebody introduced me to a small company I never heard of that actually serviced Wall Street. And it was a company, lo and behold, that was next door to a department store called Bloomingdale's. And the name of the company was Bloomberg. And I was like, huh. And what I found out when I asked a couple of my friends if they've heard of it, they said, I've never heard of Bloomberg, but I've heard of Bloomingdale's. What's the difference? and they were only a block apart. So let me stop there. Is that clear so far?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, very very interesting how there are all these little nicks or nooks and crannies in a career path that go unexplored. And I'm just thinking about an analogy here. I'm not quite sure if it's the right one, but you know, if you think about a cave or a little cavern, and it's never straight, but there's so much space on the side. There's so much to explore in the sort of adjacent spaces and parallel spaces, and some of the most interesting people in the world have found those things.
Ben, that's a great metaphor. What we know about that cavern, it exists. You know you're standing in time and space somewhere in it. You don't know its size. Mm. Somebody may have told you along the way, yeah, there's more twists and turns and stalagmites and stalactites and all these things. But until you actually see it for yourself, you're only scratching the surface. Mm. And that is a great analogy, because as I was walking in this cavern called Wall Street, until I got to Wall Street, I really didn't understand the size and the scale of this cavern. And it was through the good news is meeting individuals along the way that whisper things in your ear about things you didn't necessarily know are sometimes excellent cues to go explore around the corner that you otherwise wouldn't have known, but you're grateful for that small little interchange that you didn't think had an impact at the time. And then that twist and turn becomes something way beyond expectations. And that's exactly what happened when somebody told me to reach out to Bloomberg.
That must have been a very interesting education as well.
Indeed it was. And to put into perspective, when I joined this firm that nobody heard of, I was the 190th employee in the company, and revenues were at approximately $70 million. Hmm. Now, this was 1989. And that seemed, oh, wow, that's pretty good. And I met this guy named Mike Bloomberg, and I said, my goodness, this guy's awesome. Who is this guy, and who is this firm? And there was a tremendous energy to it, and there was something that I joined that company not just because I'm a genius, but because I made a phone call one day for something that I didn't know I was walking into. Long story short, Ben, 14 years later, I left when there were approximately 8,000 employees. Revenues were $3.5 billion. Fast forward to today, 17,000 employees, 9 or 10 billion in revenue, and I work with them in a consulting capacity. Mm. So that twist and turn that I didn't expect was the best phone call I have ever made in my career. And I praise the Lord and thank whoever is up there looking out after us for leading me in that cavern, or at least the mountaineer in me likes to say, I fell in a few crevasses, I dusted myself off, I got back up onto the trail, I kept walking, I got snowed on, I got rained on, I kept walking. It's one of those, and before you know it, the sun comes out and you are just living high.
Let's talk a little bit, well, I'd like to talk a little bit about that, but actually, you mentioned Mike Bloomberg there, and I've heard you talk about him in other conversations, and I'm just curious, you mentioned, you know, this was this amazing man that you worked with. Can you talk a little bit about what made him such an amazing person to work for?
Yeah, you know, when you meet somebody that captures your imagination, that draws you into their gravity, when you stand back and you consider what is it about this individual that is so dynamic and makes you want to be a part of his mission. And when I met him, his first impression, yeah, this is a really smart guy. Okay, there's a lot of smart guys on Wall Street. Mm. What really drove him, it was beyond all of that, it was the values that he espoused, that he lived and he led by example. And he was so team-oriented, and he recognized that 1 + 1 = 3. And the organization that he built was way beyond any technical proficiency and all about exercising or having the freedom to use the talents and all the things that God gave us in the service of our clients, because that's always the right thing to do. And when I saw that, people have sometimes bad impressions of Wall Street as if there's just a bunch of gunslingers who are looking out for their own self-interests. When I came to this organization, it was completely the opposite. It was a company that stood on the values of integrity, that valued communication skills, but more than anything else, valued the individualism, the talents and the skills that you were able to bring that don't necessarily appear on a transcript, on a grade, on a report card. It was, what are you doing today in the service of helping lead this mission? And it's something you feel. It's not always something that you could just articulate on a piece of paper. It's what drives you to wake up in the morning recognizing you are there to add value to this organization. And it was a daily event that made me proud. And it was through his incredible leadership and dynamism and desire to bring up on for his ride that I learned more in just my first few months there than I did in my 4 years of college.
That's very telling. That's an excellent training ground and more, I'm sure, for you. Indeed. I'd like to transition a little bit about into climbing and the world of climbing and how you got involved in it, and then journey back into, you know, the business world. But when did this climbing bug hit you? When did you start to get into it?
Yeah, actually, there is a story here that is the catalyst behind what happened is, well, first, in my 20s and my 30s, I'm a distance runner. And I ran my first New York Marathon when I was 26. And I also grew up in a winter wonderland. So I grew up in a world that valued skiing and skating. And I was always at home in the cold weather. Out of the blue, I'd heard about this book written by a guy named John Krakauer. And the book was called Into Thin Air. And I read the book, and as I was reading the book, and it recounted are you familiar with the book, Ben?
Yes, I have it. I have it somewhere with me as well. It's a great book, yeah.
Kidding. Well, yeah. It's not only a great book, it changed my life. Mm. And as I was reading it, and I read it more because as a distance runner, you have a certain mentality about pace, cadence, and recognizing that every step takes you a little bit closer to that finish line. And I don't know, something happened inside of me that I just picked up the book. And even though it recounted the disaster of 1996 on Mount Everest, it drew me in right from the get-go. And I said, oh my God, as I was reading the description of mountaineering, I said, wow, a lot of applies to the mindset that I bring to my running. This could be cool. I love the cold weather. What the heck? Let me see if I can just try this. So then I just started digesting every book on the Everest disaster that was ever written.
Right.
In parallel to that, I hired a guy to take me up to these rock formations about an hour from home called the Shawangunk Mountains, and I learned to rock climb. And I learned that really as the basis of, I wonder if I could climb a mountain. Well, fast forward to September 11th, 2001. Being the New Yorker, I actually had a speech booked, and I was giving a speech at 3 o'clock on the afternoon at 9/11 on the 107th floor of the World Trade Center.
Wow.
You can imagine I never made it down that morning, but three of my colleagues did that never made it out of the building. That 9/11 incident, after having read all of these books on mountaineering, I said, how am I going to honor the spirit of my three colleagues who were there in the service of my speech? They were two 24-year-olds and a 22-year-old.
Wow.
And I remember the hardest thing I ever did in my career when I was actually in the building after in the Bloomberg building, I actually called the parents of these individuals. There is nothing. There is no college. There is no training that can prepare you to make those kinds of calls. On the day, about 2 hours after the buildings collapsed, and it was my responsibility. They were there because of me.
Wow.
And when I called those parents, and particularly being a strong communicator, I was not only asked to make those calls because of my communication skills, I was the guy that they were there in service of my speech. It was the least I could do. But I didn't know exactly what I was going to say to the parents because we were all in this incredible unknown world. We were shocked. It was just so much we didn't know. That story, though, became the impetus. As I was heading home that night, I was thinking, how am I going to honor the spirit of these young men? And can it integrate in a way that I've been something I've wanted to do for a couple of years, but I kept telling myself that I was too busy? Let me stop there.
I want to take that a little bit further and understand some of the expeditions that you started to do and and what you found along the way.
Yeah, you bet. Well, so after that, exactly a year later, on 9/11/2002, I stood on the summit of a mountain in the Cascade Mountains in Washington State called Mount Rainier, and it is quite a phenomenal, beautiful mountain. And what I didn't know was when I climbed the mountain, after all those books that were in my head after the events of 9/11, I said, "Wow, how am I going to? What's this going to be like?" Little did I know, my goodness, it was like a fish in water. I unleashed a beast, and I said, "Oh my God, I love this mountain climbing thing." I didn't know what to expect, but I'm totally exhausted. As I was in a Starbucks the two mornings later, heading home, I said, "I don't know what this is, but I am not going to stop because I'm loving this." Years later, I stood on the summit of Kilimanjaro. A year later, I'm climbing the Matterhorn. Then I hit the Andes. But I think it was, in fact, I'm certain, and I shouldn't soften this, I am certain, it was on Kilimanjaro that something changed. And Kilimanjaro takes about 5.5 days. It took 5.5 days to ascend. And it's not a technical climb in the way the Matterhorn or Mount Washington or Mount Rainier is. You are not connected with ropes, belays, and harnesses.
Right.
It's actually a hike without the technical requirements. However, it is a high altitude hike at 19,300 feet. Mm-hmm. It is akin to a marathon. So the marathons that I could normally run in 4 hours, it's about pace. It's about timing. It's about how you feel. Sometimes you're flying. Sometimes you're staggering. But you're always doing your best to move ahead. The difference with Rainier is there was a team of 13 of us with 36 porters to assist our ascent. It was a massive lesson in coordination, in the unification of efforts, and in the need to get to the summit and then get home in one piece. Collaborate all the way up and all the way down. Let me stop there.
I love that, and I'd like to explore that a little bit more. And the thing I wanted to, so I spoke to Kathy O'Dowd, who you may know or you may have heard of, who is the first woman to have summited Everest from both the north and the south sides.
Indeed. I know of her, though we've never met.
She and I'm just fascinated by this world and the. All of the variables and all of the things that could go wrong on the side of a mountain. It's so fascinating. The what you talk about in terms of both communication and planning and risk and uncertainty. And I know that you've had some experiences of things going wrong. And to me, this is why you do these sorts of things. You don't really know what's going to happen when you start climbing. You don't know about the weather. There's so many variables that could change. And I wanted to maybe get into a discussion around, well, what to do when things don't go according to plan.
Yeah. Welcome to the world of mountaineering. Welcome to the career, indeed. In fact, I think when I tie mountaineering and career, there are so many stories that I have. If I may, I'll relate one that I think was a teaching moment for me.
Yeah.
One of the mountains I climbed, as many mountaineers know, each of the continents of the earth has a tallest mountain, and it's called a seven summit. So of the seven continents, there are seven summits. Mount Kilimanjaro is the tallest in Africa, so that is one of the seven summits. Another one, Europe's geographically tallest mountain, is called Mount Elbrus, and it is in the Caucasus Mountains. In Russia, on the border of Georgia, and not far from Sochi, where the Olympics was. When we climbed Mount Elbrus, it is 18,500 feet high. We got to the summit. I don't know, it took 8 or 9 days to get to that summit. It was on the way down that the unexpected happened. And this is what I hope is both a teachable moment, but also one that just is in my head all of the time as I consider what could go wrong. After we have made the summit, everybody has an elation and everybody's feeling good about it. We started our descent. I was about 1,000 feet, vertical feet short or below the summit, heading down, when all of a sudden, and I had on my foot crampons, those 12-point steel things that keep you grounded, and I had an ice in my right hand. I was also, at the time of this incident, I was disconnected from my team because we felt at that point we didn't need necessarily to be all connected. we could disconnect and walk freely down the mountain for the next couple of days. Lo and behold, little did I know, there was an exposed rock that my crampon stepped on. As I hit that exposed rock, I slipped and I fell off the mountain heading down fast. And when you fall down a mountain and you are descending at a rapid rate, something we're trained to do, you do what's called a self-arrest. You take your ice axe, you jab it into the mountain. You take your two crampons on each feet, you jab it in, and you arrest yourself to keep yourself from further falling. Mm-hmm. And that was, didn't see it coming, didn't expect it, thought we were home free. I'm hanging on the side of a mountain, and I hear from my mountain guide, his name is Mark, and I'll never forget, he screams down, Chuck, are you okay? Yes, I am. Are you stable? I am. Hang on. A couple minutes later, he comes down, and I see him tied with a rope, and he is anchored to many of the other individuals at the top of that mountain where I fell on the rock. And he comes down, and he says, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. I think I'm more embarrassed and ashamed that I slipped on the rock. Right then and there, I thought I was just going to hustle up and get up, get just as fast as I can. Mark immediately clipped me in from his harness to mine, so I am now stable and I am tied to him. He is tied to the mountaineers that are up above. But instead of hustling up, he looked me in the eye, given that we were peaceful and stable and safe. And instead of rushing up, he said, hold on. Look at that sun. Look around. Look how grateful we are. And I said to him, this is amazing. And he said, and I said, don't you want to hurry up? He said, no. This is not the time. Let's just be grateful for all the things that you're safe and I'm safe and the team is up there and they're waiting for you. And let's just take this in. Let's just use this moment to reflect on this amazing experience that we're having. It was an utter act. Now, this is a guy who is a phenomenal mountaineer. Tremendously technically proficient in ways I could never imagine. At that moment, he helped me to redefine or to look differently at the definition of a great mountaineer. And in fact, what he was really doing, I was paralleling it to my careers. Some of my greatest moments were either in that position as the giver of that or as the receiver of that. And it was one of those moments in time that you capture, that you plant inside your head and your heart, because it had nothing to do with technical expertise. It had everything to do with the reaction to the unexpected and the kindness and generosity that pours out from these incredible leaders who use their emotional intelligence to lock their followers into a place of security and feeling good. And recognizing there's no mistakes here. There's just feedback. And if something happens along the way that we didn't expect, shake it off. It's okay. We're going to get through this and we're going to get through it together. And I remember the terror of falling off of that mountain and then the incredible generosity that we call in mountaineering the law of reciprocity. Somebody gives you love and kindness, you're going to give it right back. And if you all do it together, it becomes a force multiplier to be able to achieve our common goals and objectives. That, Ben, is a career in addition to a mountaineering experience.
What an awesome story, and what a great lesson about leadership.
Indeed. And he just demonstrated it. And, you know, as a leader myself, not on the mountain, I was very comfortable on a mountain, but I didn't grow up on one, and I'm not a professional mountaineer. Yeah. I'm a amateur mountaineer. However, I was a professional salesman, spokesman, Wall Streeter, and it was so easy to look at, wow, it's a metaphor for our careers. I've had these moments. They were on solid ground, but they felt every bit the same, that somebody tripped and fell and they were in an acquisition or something they didn't expect and they're falling off a cliff and we're going to help them. And a good person, I think there's something about the world that conspires to help and to recognize that we are in this together and that all of us is better than any one of us. That's acting. That's a symphony orchestra. That's a mountaineering team. That's two guys Skyping on a podcast. Yeah. We are closer together than we are apart.
It's a wonderful analogy. And because this mountaineering metaphor, and talking to Kathy several months ago, she was saying that, you know, the mountaineering, the climbing metaphor is often misused in business because it's sort of, you know, we're climbing to the top and we're going to get there at all costs. And it's a similar sort of a thing, you know, as a distance runner, you well know that you don't go from, you know, mile zero to mile 26, just like that. And through sheer willpower, there's a journey along the way. And, and the other thing I wanted to actually raise, you know how, so I was watching some of your interviews and looking at some of your stuff today. And I was also, as I was scrolling through my social media feed and the like, you know how you kind of, you pick up on things that you didn't know were there. And so today all these sort of climbing and mountaineering analogies started to pop out at me. So either someone's trying to tell me something.
That happens.
Yeah. But the one that really struck me was Robert Pirsig, who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. If you've read that book, but
I did. Great book.
So this quote just came at me, and I wrote it down because it relates back to your story a little bit. And it, so he says in a quote, "To live only for some future goal is shallow. It's the sides of the mountain that sustain life, not the top."
Ah, that's beautiful. Yeah. Well, that's the journey. You know, yeah. What I was recounting in my story on Elbrus. Yeah, we made the summit. And I'd love to say that was a highlight, and it certainly was, mm-hmm. but that's not what I walked away with. I mm-hmm. walked away with something that I didn't expect, that I tripped, that it was something that was in front of me that caused what I thought could have been a disaster. But when I recount Elbrus, I don't recount the high peak. I recount the moment in time that the law of reciprocity played out. And that somebody did what they were trained to do in the service, not just of my success, but in the service of saving my life. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe more dramatic than it needed to be, because I never felt that I was going to die. But I did feel terror, and that I had to shut that off and do what I was trained to do. That's no different than a career when you're in the hot seat. And someone's coming at you, and you use your emotional intelligence tools, your self-awareness, to recognize I'm going to have to stay calm and focused and understand that right now I have a goal that I need to achieve and a mission that I need to accomplish. And you keep calm and you move on and you take a step at a time. So indeed, I agree with you. And it's a whirlwind of so many ways that we can use this metaphor, whether they're used or misused. It is just appropriate in so many circumstances.
Right. I'd like to stick on this related theme a little bit, because you also talk about agility and adaptability, which I think, you know, is something that we all need to do and have when we're managing our careers or, you know, managing our personal lives. And again, I think there's a similar analogy in terms of what you experience mountain climbing. Having said that, and you can talk to me about this far more than I would ever know, but there's probably a huge amount of planning that goes into any expedition. So you do all this planning and thinking through, and then, but at the same time, you need to be adaptable. So how do you manage a situation where, look, you've got your goal, you've got your plan, but where do you need to deviate a little bit? When do you know that you need to be a little adaptable, adjust to conditions, employ agility, and not stick so rigidly to a plan? Yeah, I'd be very curious about your thoughts on this.
Yeah, you bet. And you're the way you framed that is apropos, because before you go on an expedition, you get a list of things that you need, and that's a massive list. And you take a duffel bag half the size of Lake Michigan. It's this massive bag, and you bring your big backpack as well. So what you know is in your mind. You have filled that bag with the massive amount of stuff. However, what you're really describing is when you get onto that mountain, or you get onto a career, whatever that is, and I'll stay in the mountain focus for now. What you know is sometimes as you set off, you don't know what the mountain's going to give you, but you recognize that you're going to have to react to what it gives you at any given moment in time. And the reason I say that, because what the mountain gives you that you can't control is weather. Mm-hmm. It's the conditions of the paths. It is bumping in or potentially running into other climbers that you don't know and you don't have any reason to trust. But sometimes the agility that you develop is developed in response to what it is you are able to receive and adjust to. And I'll give a great example. We were climbing the Matterhorn and we had a training, an acclimatization training a couple days before on a different mountain near it. And we climbed the mountain, we summited the mountain, it took about a day to get there. And as we were coming down, there was something that wasn't supposed to be there. And we walked right into what looked like a crevasse. And what we knew is if we just walked right through it, we didn't know how deep it was, but if we walked right through it, we were an hour away from getting to the bottom of the mountain. And what happened is we hit that, our guides started checking. They started to see how deep is this, and they couldn't tell. Long story short, instead of the hour that we used to walk off of that mountain, we actually had to go back and climb the mountain again and get off the other side, and it added 7 hours to our time. And we were beat. We had nothing left to give, at least so I thought. But the reason I'm using that is because we had to be agile because the mountain was giving us something that required a response from us. And in that case, the only response was to change our direction, change our tactics in a world where we were exhausted, but it was either that or fall into the abyss. Mm. And I think a lot of where we draw that metaphor as communicators, a lot of times when you are speaking, you don't know what's going to be coming at you or what it is you are going to receive from the person who you said something to. Mm. Just like that's the mountain. The emotional agility, the ability to understand and to take time in your mind between the action and the response of your next move is critical to determine how you are going to advance up the mountain and how you're going to advance in that conversation. So this emotional agility that I use often in my practice, it helps us to understand our own awareness, social awareness, but also providing times instead of reacting. We go into our own head and heart. We take time. We breathe. We give ourselves a couple of seconds to collect our thoughts and to figure out our next move. And I say that because in this high-tech world that moves at 100 miles an hour, I'm afraid we're losing some of that conditioned response and we're just knee-jerking everything.
Yeah, I agree.
Actions don't have a place on a mountain and they don't have a place in a career. Even when the stakes aren't that high, I think we owe more to each other to be able to be more agile, more thoughtful, and more mindful for how we communicate to each other.
Mm-hmm. Is there, so just to pick up on that, is there a practice that you perhaps took away that from that experience that you, in your coaching, you provide, so you know when things go wrong or certain techniques that you work with your clients around to help them be a little more adaptable?
Indeed, I do. In fact, in my book is called The Climb to the Top, and the subheading of the book is called Leadership and Communication Tactics to Take Your Career to New Heights. And in one of the chapters, I devoted an entire chapter to what's called the power of the pause. Mm. And Mark Twain had said, and I'm a big fan of his, and I devoted that chapter to many of his techniques, but he said, no word is ever as powerful as a rightly timed pause. And the reason that tactic is important, because as I've described, many of the executives that I coach in communication, they are in rapid fire mode. Their action, their response is fast and quick and sometimes thoughtless. So the tactic that I recommend most that seems really unnatural to most people and incredibly awkward is simply called the power of the pause. And I use that because a pause can be a split second or actually could be 2 or 3 seconds. It is amazing the difference that people's reactions are going to be when they knee jerk or we do take two. And instead of knee jerking, they're actually silent. They have radio silence for about 2 or 3 seconds. And I teach them that in that time between what you put in your head that you may not particularly like, and that background conversation conversation in your head, makes it to the foreground, it goes through a filter, and it comes out of your mouth. Hmm. And if the wrong thing comes out of your mouth, that genie's not going back in the bottle. So the tactic that I teach, that is actually a lot of fun to teach because most people are so uncomfortable with it, is stopping, just like I'm doing now, breathing. That gives one about 2 or 3 seconds to rethink what they were about to say. And I do that because in my practice, I coach a lot of people to be excellent presenters, but I needed to do that to do this to help them in impromptu responses. And when they need to improvise a response, it's rarely done in knee-jerk mode well. Hmm. It's usually at the pause. At the 2 to 3 second silence is when they have had a sufficient time to be able to respond. People will not remember the 2 or 3 seconds. They will remember what it is you said because it's generally captured on a camera. And it's what you say that gets quoted. No one ever gets misquoted for a pause.
Hmm.
Get my drift?
Absolutely. This is something that I've had to work on a fair amount.
And me too. I think we're all students of this.
Yes. And partly for a number of reasons, and we can diverge a little bit into some of the contents of your book, but I did want to go back and we'll put a pin in your background and the transition from or the parallels between business and climbing. But I wanted to talk about this a little bit. I have a bit of, I think, kryptonite in terms of my communication style. And I think others do as well. And that is, I do a lot of, I do filler words, right? So I put my ums and my ahs and my you knows and things like this. Uh-huh. A lot of people do. When I notice it, I don't do it. But right. When I'm not paying any attention, or if my mind is going at, and my mind goes at 120 kilometers an hour or faster, and I'm thinking then, while so I'm formulating my thoughts, and they don't come out clearly. And when I do that, it doesn't sound great. And when I pause, the audience doesn't really notice because they're listening. They're not as listening as quickly as I'm thinking.
Yeah. It's hysterical.
So I'm curious about how you treat that or how you deal with that. Is that part of the coaching that you do and some of the things in your book?
In fact, it is not only in my book. Mm. It is chapter 3. It is an entire chapter devoted to what we call filler words. Some people call them verbal crutches. They're one and the same.
Right.
And I would say if there is one thing that I work on more than anything else, it is that.
Mm.
Because particularly the millennial generation, I'll pick on them for just a bit. They got it a lot worse because every response begins with the word so. I asked them, if you eliminated the word so, does it change your answer? And they think about it. So no. Okay. Now try saying that without the so. The words kind of, sort of, you know, I mean, it's like, especially the word like, my goodness, what has happened? So in chapter 3 of my book called Speak with Conviction, the entire chapter is dedicated to the complete eradication of filler words.
Right.
And really the practice, or this is how it gets solved. When I put my clients on videotape, the majority of them are not even aware of it. They just mindlessly, so, you know, it's like, I mean, you know, it's, you know, kind of sort of like, yeah. And I was like, that's how you're going to start? Well, I don't know. What else is there? I said, well, let's try. First of all, they are incredibly inefficient. People are going to believe, or at least perceive, that if you're saying kind of and sort of, you are not speaking with conviction because you're busy softening everything. So if you say, yeah, that cheeseburger is great, well, it's sort of kind of, you know, it's like, you know, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? So what I do is I help raise the consciousness, even for those that are not aware of it. Usually on the videotape, when they watch it, they start turning red. They said, oh my God, I didn't know I did that. And then they really don't appreciate the absence of filler words until they don't speak with them anymore. And they realize, oh my God, this is so much more efficient. So what I do, I ask my coachees, don't do this with your spouse because it's going to seem unnatural. But I am going to ask you to do this with your mates in the office. And you are going to ask them that every time you say something with a filler word, and I lay out the list, kind of, sort of, you know, it's like, I mean, you know, that. They are going to tell you, you just spoke in a filler word and you're not even conscious of it. I want you to be conscious of it. And when they do, they are going to tell you, rewind the tape and say it again. It is amazing that I once did a speech with a guy that did 54. He came back a week later, he cut it down to 22. He came back a week later, he cut it down to 4. And on the last speech, he was down to 1. He was practicing that technique with his mates because they were all equally committed to the eradication of these verbal crutches. It begins with a mindset and intent. And once you are aware you're doing it, then all of a sudden you kick into another place. And then when you see yourself on video absent the filler words, it's like the whole world just changed. It's awesome to see it.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. Another way of doing it is starting your own podcast and editing your own podcast. Oh my God.
Yeah, the problem is my clients, and particularly if they're in a press conference, they don't have that luxury.
No, that's right. That's right.
And when they're up on that stage and somebody asks them a question, they are laser focused on as quickly as they can with no inefficient, weak, wavering words in their way. Speak quickly, efficiently, and powerfully. And that cannot be done when your entire sentence is filled first, that precedes with so, and then they wait, and then all the other words. It diminishes your power and capacity. In a world, what we're trying to do is to build up and get people to notice that power. These weak, wavering words work against it. So it is in the axis of evil, these words that we try to eliminate.
That's correct. That's great. One of the other filler phrases I used to use is, I don't know. I'll say, well, this is what I think. I don't know, blah, blah, blah. It's, what yeah. the hell, man? You do know. Why do you say I don't yeah. know?
Yeah, That's not a lot different than kind of, sort of, you're just looking to kill time. You actually yes. do know. So, yes. so much of this is just a tactic. However, what I say to my clients is, think about the difference. If you were to say, oh, I don't know, it's maybe like a cheeseburger tonight. Think about if you had silence instead. In fact, if you were to look at the difference, what do you prefer? A filler word or nothing? And this is clearly a case where we prefer a pause and silence, because the filler word usually leads to another filler word. And yet you haven't answered the question. All you've done is just created this spiral of words that are unnecessary. So why would we use those words? Because in the absence of those words, you're getting to the same thing. So yeah, so Ben, you're on it. And
I have to be very vigilant about it because it creeps back in. So very good reminder.
Being a strong communicator takes vigilance. A rigor to communication. We think of rigor as being applied to math and science and those really hard skills. Yet communication, because everybody learns to talk, that doesn't mean that everybody learns to communicate. And what we do in our practice is we apply the mindset of the same rigor that people apply to math and science, we apply to communication. Because absent that rigor, it's the communication, poor communication, both spoken, body language, or otherwise, it gets you into trouble. So why don't we give it the respect it deserves and treat it with the same sense of rigor as you would as if you're putting an airplane up in the sky?
You're absolutely right. You are absolutely right. We've gone from the side of a mountain to filler words. So there's a gap here that we need to fill. So I wanted to just cover off a few things. So you got into mountain climbing. Were you doing this in parallel to the work that you were doing as a hobby?
I was, yeah. I started my mountain climbing when I was 42 years old. I was at Bloomberg. I then went to a firm called Black Rock, where I continued to climb mountains. The good part about climbing a mountain, I generally did, and I continued to do, an expedition, big expedition in some place around the world, which included Alaska, the Andes, Mount Elbrus, a whole bunch of mountains. you can generally do some of these in 2 to 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So it was all in parallel. I was home raising my children with my wife, and generally it was vacation. And when I wasn't vacationing with my wife and kids, I would take the 2 to 3 weeks off every couple of years. And now I'm thinking about my next one, but it can all be done. It's just a matter of time. Some people like to go to the beach, not me. I go to the mountains. And also I take my students. I take my freshmen to New York State's highest peak in the Adirondack Mountains. It's called Mount Marcy. I take my upperclassmen to the Northeast's highest peak. It's called Mount Washington in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And I bring that mountaineering metaphor to life with a bunch of 18 and 19 year olds. And they love it. They're exhausted and they're beaten down. And they say, when's the next one, professor? And I said, this is awesome. Let's just continue to do this. So it's always climbing to new heights, or at least thinking about life begins at the end of your comfort zone. What's your next mountain and how are you going to approach it?
Very cool. Could we transition into your book?
And you bet.
Where did the idea come from to write this book?
Yeah, the idea was born, I think, as a lot of people that teach college. When I went to teach the subject matter of this, of communicating with impact, I went out, what book am I going to use? And I looked around the universe and I said, there's not a book that's a Chuck Garcia book. There's no book out there. And I borrowed a little bits and pieces of a lot of other books. That was an opportunity just waiting to happen. I said, wait a minute. This is crazy. What about I'm going to have to customize all of this. Like, this is nuts. In the time that I take to put together and weave all of these different tactics and techniques from a variety of places, I might as well write the book. So when I wrote the book about communication skills, it started with a framework to help people understand that when you communicate, there is a science to it. And it's a framework that I call the 10 Commandments of Great Communicators. Mm. Two of those chapters we've already talked about. One of them is the power of the pause, and one of them is called Speak with Conviction, which is the elimination of filler words. But there were 8 other commandments that we haven't talked about now. But it seemed clear to me, my conclusion before I wrote this book, is that the most compelling communicators, Mike Bloomberg, Steve Jobs, there's a variety of them, the guys that climb to the top of that career mountain, one thing they have in common is they are all extraordinary communicators in some fashion. They're all different. So I said, if I write this book, I'm going to use the brand of the Wall Street Mountaineer. I'm going to use the narratives of mountain climbing because I want it to be distinct and to reflect my values and my ethos. So I said, well, let's call it A Climb to the Top, which has the career and mountaineering implication in it. The colon is leadership and communication tactics to take your career to new heights. So it was pretty easy to write what it is I'd already taught for 2 years. Because if you can teach something in a classroom and it lands to students, you can write about it. So when I wrote it, I just envisioned being in the classroom in an interactive forum with my students, teaching them the 10 commandments. And thus the book was born. Hmm. And how blessed I am. It has just been a remarkable asset in my practice. It's my calling card. It's been translated into Mandarin. Many of my students are Chinese. A book agent from China approached me and said, the soft skills that you are teaching to our students here, we could really use them in Asia, because the curriculum in Asia is very hard-focused based. Yet many of the Chinese students with aspirations to come to America, they really need to learn and have a good balance between the hard and the soft skills. So that was another great opportunity where the book was written. We translated into Mandarin. I headed to China many times and had book tours in many cities in China. And we brought these soft skills to a whole nother culture and prepared them to come to America. And now I do work for Chinese companies and I help them to communicate. So it's just been a wonderful culmination of cultures, really revolved around that one common theme, and that's communicating powerfully.
I'm not sure who said this. I think it was it Peter Drucker? I'm pretty sure it's Peter Drucker, actually, who said, communication is what the listener does.
Yeah, that was Peter Drucker.
That was, yes, yeah. Right.
He was a smart guy.
Yes, yeah, just a little bit. I wanted to get your thoughts on what makes a great communicator,
yeah,
a little bit, and relate it back to some of the lessons in your book.
Yeah,
I know you can talk about this for probably hours, and you teach a whole course on it. But maybe at a high level, I think it would be great.
No, I can synthesize this quite quickly, because there is a book that had a big impact on me, and it's Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Sure. And in one of those chapters, he talked about, or of the seven habits, one of those habits is seek first to understand, pause, then to be understood. And that chapter, the context of that chapter is when you're communicating is to speak with purpose and to listen with intent. And if we think about the bimodal statement there, speak with purpose, listen with intent. Communication is not just getting up and blabbing. What he is saying in that statement is that God gave us two ears and one mouth, so we better listen twice as much as we talk. But what makes a great communicator is the right integration between being able to first listen, seek first to understand. Then the second thing is seeking to be understood. Look at the sequence that Covey suggested about a strong communicator. It wasn't speaking. The first act is understanding. And I love that about it. So even though I wrote the book as a communication tool, it is that listening is as powerful, if not first, in the hierarchy of needs before you speak. And if you get those two right, you got to get the first one right, then you get the second one right. That is a great communicator.
Mm-hmm. There's an element as well in all of this that you weave in, and that's the whole emotional intelligence piece. Because we live in this sort of hack culture, right? So someone who's listening to this might want to pick up your book and say, right, so this is the formula that you're giving me, and apply that scientifically to communication. And I think what you're saying is it doesn't work like that.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. I think what great leaders do is they many times do something that is counterintuitive and may seem awkward to the person who is listening to their lesson. But I think that's the good thing, that we sometimes defy convention and we think differently. And I think that's where you get noticed, and that's where people really begin to see, wow, you know, our job is to help them to see things in different ways. And when you bring about a lesson that they've been hardwired, that they now have to think differently, it might take a little while to come to it, but I think that's what we do as leaders. We provoke, we inspire, we persuade, and we provoke change. And one way to provoke change is to say and do things differently in ways that people don't expect, so that you get their attention.
Mm-hmm. And the emotional intelligence piece comes, you know, certainly listening is important, but there's a piece of empathy around all of that, putting yourself in someone else's shoes. Whenever I've been around a great leader, they somehow are able to do that. They're not just analytical people. They're able to not just communicate well, and because, you know, great preachers, they communicate well and clearly and all of the things that you're talking about, but great leaders always tailor their message in a way that really resonates with their audience.
Indeed. In fact, I think it can be boiled down into that empathy, or the empathetic leader is, I feel your pain.
Right.
And as us as human beings, we have mirror neurons inside us. So if you watch a plane, you know, you watch something crash, it makes you feel a certain way. You're not involved in the crash, and you're certainly not being impacted by it, yet you feel the pain. You can't look away, and it hurts. When we are speaking to each other, the preacher, the teacher, the leader, the really good ones are able to feel your pain. They identify with it. The self-awareness that comes with high EQ individuals is helping one to be empathetic, and not only to feel someone else's pain, but being able to acknowledge it, to relate to it, to respond to it, All of that is a critical component of how you develop into the kind of leader that I hope many of us aspire to be. And that emotional intelligence piece, which I took years to really understand and appreciate, it is often in my coaching assignments, I have to go there first and help with the development of EQ from the inside if we expect for them to perform on the outside.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense, and it's very, very powerful. Yeah. I wanted to get into a couple of areas before we start to wrap it up. And one is, I know we've talked around risk and uncertainty a little bit, but I wanted to get your own views around the topic. And in your experience, how do great leaders deal with risk and uncertainty?
Yeah, well, that is so topical, particularly to the Wall Street world that I've lived in, and also to the mountain. I think one of the things, and I see it in the generation coming up, many of them are afraid to make mistakes. And as a result of that, if you fear making a mistake, those fears become your limits. The great leaders recognize that risk-taking is not something to avoid, but it's something to understand and to learn how to manage. That you recognize when you're on a road, you know the sides of the road. You get that. You know the boundaries that you can try to push without being reckless. And the great leaders recognize that with great risk often comes great outcomes. But they recognize that you're never going to do something dangerous, but you're never afraid to begin to push that envelope, that you're going to take a risk, because absent risk, you're never going to change a status quo. So you realize it's something you can embrace, but you develop the tools and the mindset to be able to lead it and manage it. And if things go wrong, okay, you handle it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great philosophy, and certainly one that resonates with me. Risk is something that's so poorly understood, and what you talk about is something we need to do a lot more of and be a lot better at. At the same time, being a great communicator is a great way of managing uncertainty in your personal career, but also getting through a crisis, because if you've got those communication skills, you can get your team around you, organize things, get your message across clearly, and that's where things fall down. If you look at any major corporate crisis, it's usually there's some massive failure of communication along the way.
Oh, without a doubt, your point is a good one. It is normally perfect underscore, a failure of communication. Things are going to happen, but if you communicate them appropriately, you manage them. If not, the bad communication spirals into more disaster. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to be, I want to be respectful of your time, but I do want to finally touch on some of your teaching. And you talk a little bit about millennials and taking your classes to the mountains and things along those lines. And I'm curious around I want to know what your impressions are of the millennial generation, the kids that you teach, in terms of how they're absorbing some of your messages. And sometimes I think millennials get a bit of a bad rap, but I'm curious what your experience has been with this generation.
Yeah, it's been incredibly positive. And I think part of the bad rap, it's not their fault. It's just they've grown up in a world they don't know any different. They grew up in a world with a phone in their hand. Mm-hmm. And that phone can be a weapon of mass distraction. It is a blessing and it's a curse. But for the most part, they're incredibly idealistic. They see the world in ways that they want to make it a better place. They are very smart. They are highly intelligent, my students. They're also growing up a little bit of, and I say that, it's not a weak, wavering word. There is a touch of fear of failure. There is so much pressure to perform because they are given so many tremendous tools that anything less than perfection is disappointing. So part of what I do within the mindset is we're not going to think that way. But if you're, and I tell them what I learned from Mike Bloomberg, if you're not making mistakes, you're not trying hard enough. So we're going to make this class a safe zone. There's nobody watching. We're not going to put any cameras on. And I want you to come into this class, particularly when I'm teaching communication. I want you to make mistakes. We don't want perfect sheep or robots. We want people. We want you to show vulnerability. And we want you to learn from the mistakes. There's no failure here. There's just feedback. And every time you make a mistake, you learn from it. So once you can get that and you can plant those expectations in your head and recognize that this is a good place to be, that and there's something much more than just your transcript. These are all of these things we teach that don't appear on the transcript but will be your best friend when you go into the interview when you start your career.
Yeah, I think that the fact that the millennials have grown up with social media and everything's curated. So you can create the perfect picture of your home, your relationship status, your travels, etc. Because, you know, let's face it, for every selfie that gets posted on Facebook or Instagram, you know, you can take, oh, sorry, there's that, you know, word. Apologies.
I'm not going to beat you up on that.
Yeah. We're just talking about making mistakes. But for every selfie, you know, there are 10 outtakes. But what gets transmitted is this curated, right. You know, this curated world. And right. I think that's it's difficult for millennials to accept that if the cameras are rolling live or if you often don't have control over that Facebook feed that you project out into the world.
That's correct. That's a perfect perspective. I like the way that you said that. Spot on.
Right.
You know?
You know, yes, I know.
It's like, yeah.
But I think we all suffer from that a little bit. I know that I suffer from distraction because of social media. I've had to take efforts to make sure that my phone, for example, is not in the same room in which I sleep. I need right. to make sure I shut it off. I need to make sure I don't put it on the table when I'm speaking to someone, all of that stuff. So it's not just millennials that are suffering from all of this. It's all of us.
We have all become addicted to these machines, and part of that is recognizing when they're important, but being mindful enough to know when to leave them behind. And then just look into the eyes of the person that you're talking to, bag all of the communication devices, and just have a conversation and show that you speak with purpose and listen with intent. Because what I use often, and I quoted her in my book, Maya Angelou, the wonderful poet and mm-hmm. activist, she said, people will forget what you say, people will forget what you do, but they will never forget how you make them feel. Mm-hmm. And we carry those lessons, and I think as the empathetic leader, communicator, we say more from the things we don't say. It's what we do and how we act and how we make people feel in our presence. And if I had to just conclude this wonderful podcast with you, Ben, in one way, it's just how do we make others feel? And everybody wants to feel like they're important and that they're noticed and that they're appreciated. And if we as leaders, that's our job, make them feel good about what they're doing, and they're going to pay it all back.
That's a great way to wrap things up. But before we do, was there anything that you wanted to mention that we didn't get a chance to cover?
No, Ben, I think this has been wonderful. I think we've covered, we're just trying to be the disciplined communicator and keep this focused in what we set out to do. I think we've covered all of those highlights, and thank you. It's been a wonderful experience talking with you. I hope that when others listen to it, our hope is always a call to action, that we leave them with something tangible. And what I hope that we can do is leave them with the desire to be inspired, persuaded, provoked, recognizing that life does begin at the end of your comfort zone. Those mountains, proverbial mountains, career mountains, they're waiting for you. And they're not something to avoid with the risk that comes inherent in those climbs, but something to manage. And learning from the masters, your teachers, we're all each other's teachers, that in spite of the fact that you may stumble and fall, no worries. Just get back up, dust it off. Keep walking.
That's great. That's awesome. Chuck, where can my listeners find you and learn more about you and buy your book and all of that great stuff.
I'd love to. Well, everything is contained in my website. It is chuckgarcia.com. And from there, you'll see all of my contact information. You can also take a communications assessment. I've provided my own proprietary tool that anyone can go into the assessment tab on chuckgarcia.com, and you can answer a whole lot of questions. When you hit the submit button about your communication tactics and how you feel, it goes to me, not anyone on my staff. I read it and I will respond and point out some things. You'll notice that on there is my book, called The Climb to the Top, Leadership Communication Tactics to Take Your Career to New Heights, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. But it is all there to help you to become more powerful, hopefully more successful, and you feel better about your communication techniques in a world where it is about the most challenging thing you could ever do.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Chuck. I really enjoyed this. This was great. And
thank you.
Wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much once again.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure to visit with you, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Sounds great. All right. Yeah. Bye. Thanks. For now. So pretty cool, right? Check out the show notes and try Chuck's public speaking assessment that he mentioned. It's very useful. As always, if you like all things Risk, give us a rating or review on iTunes, or simply give us a recommendation to someone you know would enjoy the show, and or start your free Audible trial and get your free audiobook. We'll be back soon. We've got some great conversations lined up that I think you'll all thoroughly enjoy and get a lot out of. If you don't want to miss anything, go to allthingsrisk.co.uk, that's .co.uk, and subscribe. And if you want some more in between our episodes, give us a follow on Twitter or Facebook, or just drop me a note, allthingsrisk@gmail.com, or anywhere else on social media. We will be back soon in the interim. And as always, don't forget, risk is life.